Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back one of our great guest hosts, Dr. Jamil Battle. Welcome, Jamil.
Welcome to you.
It's good to have you back. I hope you've been doing well, and I hope your heart's doing well, because on our show today, we've got a really interesting guest. We're going to be talking about a first three-dimensional printed heart using a patient's cells, speaking with Nadav Noor from Tel Aviv University. He and his colleagues. Pretty exciting.
That is exciting. Printing a heart using your own cells.
Yeah. First, we got some research that matters. The first one is, are the certain drugs that are sometimes used to treat a whole host of conditions, not necessarily what they were designed for, but other sorts of conditions, can they be dangerous? What are we even talking about?
So we're talking about a study published from Sweden in the BMJ.
British Medical Journal,
yeah. And they, thank you, they looked at treatment with gabapentinoids.
What are gabapentinoids?
Lyrica, gabapentin, medicines for epilepsy, nerve pain, anxiety disorders.
They're used a lot for a lot of different things. I use it all the time for kind of pain or diabetes pain or things like that, for which this says it may help a little bit.
Exactly.
What's the problem then?
So the problem is that they found there was an increased risk of suicidal behaviors, unintentional overdose, injuries, road traffic incidents, particularly in the 15 to 24 year olds, prompting them to maybe look at that research further and maybe tweak treatment guidelines for young people that are being prescribed these medications.
Yeah, this was 192,000 people between 2006 and 2013, and they found, exactly as you said, some increased risk. So there's a 26% increased risk of the suicidal behavior, death from suicide, a 24% increased risk of unintentional overdose, 22% increased risk of head and body injury, and a 13% increased risk of road traffic accidents. Now, it doesn't say that these medicines caused it. These were just some associations. The associations seem to be linked to this pregabalin, not gabapentin, or to the Lyrica, not to the Neurontin. We don't want people going out there actually stopping any of the medicines they're on. You would certainly want to talk with your doctor about this research.
That's right. This was an observational study, so certainly can't point to causality. But they did note, particularly in the 15 to 24-year-olds, as mentioned before, that there was a greater risk, and this could be due to just the fact that this age group doesn't really have a developed prefrontal cortex, and there's more impulsivity or risk-taking behavior anyway, along with the use of alcohol and illicit drugs alongside their gabapentin or Lyrica.
So you're trying to tell me some of the teenagers are missing part of their brain.
Basically.
This impulsivity. Yeah. So this is interesting. I do think it's worth more research, understanding, and perhaps more caution. Let's talk about our next research that matters, which is about something that I think a lot of people are interested in, but it is this kind of outbreaks of pertussis that seem to happen. I had a colleague not too long ago say they just had pertussis, and I have parents all the time and grandparents saying, oh, I'm expecting a child, or my child's expecting a child, I'm going to be a grandparent, and I need to get a pertussis booster. What do we need to know?
So this was a large study done by Dr. Zerbo and his colleagues at Kaiser Permanente, published in a journal of pediatrics. And essentially what they did is they retrospectively looked at an electronic health record of 469,982 children under the age of 11. So a large group of children. And they looked at dates from January 2006 to 2017 of June. And what they found was there was an increased risk of pertussis that was actually 13 times higher for children who had not been vaccinated, Those that were under vaccinated were twice as likely to develop pertussis, but they also found an increased risk of pertussis even in those fully vaccinated as more time passed since their last dose.
So it's kind of like if you haven't had it, you're at really somewhat the highest risk. If you've had it but you're kind of behind on your schedule, you're still at high risk. But even if you're updated, you still have some risk because the vaccine's not perfect.
Right.
And I think that's what it shows. I mean, they showed the majority of cases actually came in those who were vaccinated. That's because 94% of the population's vaccinated. But again, you had way disproportionate number that got it who never had been vaccinated. And that's because they didn't have any immunity. Two things it tells me. One is, if you're going to be a new grandparent, you better go out and get your pertussis booster so you don't risk that. And then we need a better vaccination. That's okay.
And that's okay. The science is not perfect. And this is why we research and ask great questions and make better products and better
products, better guidelines. Speaking of better guidelines, next research that matters, near and dear to me, because I think, you know, it reminds me of a colleague from the National Injury Center at the Centers for Disease Control who said, it's not accidents when people fall and injure their heads with scooter injuries or bicycles. These are preventable injuries. And motorized scooters are really on the rise. And we see these motorized scooters everywhere now. And a lot of times, if not most times, the people aren't using helmets like they do or should be doing when they're on bicycles.
That's right. And so this study looked at basically over a decade emergency department records. And I think they looked at the Product Safety Commission's National Electronic Injury Surveillance System, published in American Journal of Otolaryngology. And what they found that is in these emergency department records, 990 head or facial injuries were sustained from electronic scooter use, and that this tripled from, it looks like, an estimated 2,325 nationwide in 2008 to 6,947 in 2017.
Yeah, the 1,000 were just the head and facial injuries. There were 32,000 injuries nationwide. And so these rates are increasing. These are major sources of trauma. And, you know, most of the people injured were men, kind of like me, between ages 19 and 65. Maybe we're trying to relive our childhood. But we're getting on these scooters. And guess what? These scooters can go 30 miles an hour. I call them that kind of electronic injury vehicles. They can be fun, but they're really dangerous. I saw someone that was injured last year at the beach using one of these on the ocean and just went flying and had a serious concussion, had to go to the hospital. Boy, way to prevent these, wearing the helmets, making them safer, probably limiting the speed, and hopefully a lot of public education.
Exactly. I'm hoping that this study will help legislation pass so that, you know, people are required to wear their helmets.
Seems sensible to me. Speaking of sensible, our last research that matter is about sleeping with the TV on. And I can tell you some people near and dear in my family, not my wife, but maybe some in-law sort of things, that love to sleep with the TV on. Used to drive me crazy, but now I have some data that says maybe it's not good for you.
It is not good for you. And this is near and dear to my heart. And this was actually published by Dale Sandler, a scientist with the National Institute of Environmental Health, which is a division of National Institutes of Health. And what they did is they analyzed health and lifestyle data on nearly 44,000 U.S. women enrolled in an ongoing study that was seeking clues to causes of breast cancer. But they did an analysis focused on data around sleep, light exposure, and weight gain during the study.
This was in JAMA Internal Medicine, Journal of the American Medical Association. And these women who went to bed with the television on and light at night were likely to gain 11 pounds over 5 years than if people didn't do that. And they were also 30% higher risk of becoming obese. This doesn't, again, it's not cause and effect, but it certainly raises light bulbs, literally, or says the light bulbs should go out and maybe the TV should go off.
And that's right. And it makes sense just from a animal research and kind of smaller studies that they have shown that prolonged light exposure is associated with weight gain. And they think it's because there's disruption and release of hormones related to sleep and appetite when the light is misappropriately timed. So this is important as far as changing behaviors that we can do with properly timed light as a part of healthy lifestyle.
Right from your mouth to God's ears. That's going to conclude the research that matters. And we're going to actually delve more into science after the break when we talk with researcher and doctoral candidate at Tel Aviv University, Nadav Noor, about the first three-dimensional printed heart using a patient's cells. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamil Battle. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamil Battle. Today on Conversations, we're talking with researcher and doctoral candidate at Tel Aviv University, Nadav Noor, about he and his colleagues created the first 3D, three-dimensional printed heart using a patient's cells. Welcome to Your Health, Nadav.
Hello.
You know, it's great to have you on the show. When we first read about this research a number of months ago, I looked at our executive producer and I said, we need to talk more about this. This is so groundbreaking and interesting. So really appreciate you spending the time with us today. And I guess before we go into any of the science, we'd like to know a little bit about you. How did you get interested in science? Because it's not every day we have a PhD student who's first author on what could be one of the papers, if not the paper of the year in science.
Wow. I didn't expect this much, but actually I was interested in the research from a very early stage. My whole family is into it. My parents both are doctors in biology. My older brothers also. So although I had a very long military service, I always wanted to go to the academy after I finished the military service. So it was kind of my dream, actually.
And you were always interested in science?
Yeah, in science. I didn't thought I will reach to biology because I wanted to go to other directions, but that's what happens.
I remember in somewhere in middle school, maybe high school, the very first dissection I had to do was a frog's heart. And I thought, oh my goodness gracious, I don't know if I can do this. Did you have to do dissection when you were in your science?
No, I didn't do this kind of stuff.
You did it all on the computer.
Today it's casual. I'm doing it every day. Actually, just today I did two dissections of hearts of mice. So now it's every day.
What about your interest with the heart? It sounds like specifically you and the rest of your team discovered 3D printing of a heart. Can you explain to the listeners how this heart came to be?
Actually, all of our lab is focused on the heart. Mainly, we're also doing other tissues. And in the beginning, we didn't even thought of doing an whole heart. We wanted to go to more like heart patches, we call it, which is just to make a two-dimensional patch of living cells in a material and to implant it upon the scar tissue of the defaulted heart.
To try to help a heart that's had a heart attack that forms scar formation, which is tissue that doesn't work anymore, to repair that small section of diseased tissue.
Exactly. So this was our main goal in the first years. It was about 4 years ago. And in our lab, they developed a special material which is originated from the patient itself. And we believe that it will not evoke an adverse immune response after implantation.
like a rejection that people worry about when they get transplants.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
When you take the tissue from the patient's own body, you're not going in the heart and taking out the heart tissue. What type of tissue is this? Where does it come from?
No, no, of course, because we don't want to damage the heart. I mean, if it's damaged, we need every cell, every living cell in there. The idea is to take a small fatty tissue. It's called the omentum, which is fatty tissue that surrounds our intestinal organs.
Yeah, around the gut. Uh-huh.
Around the gut. So in a very small biopsy, which you can remove very easily today in a very different procedures, we use this fatty tissue and we separate the cell and the remaining acellular material. And while we take these fat cells, and we know now how to reprogram them to become stem cells, and then we know how to differentiate them into heart cells or blood vessel forming cells. And in the meantime, we take the remaining material and we process it into a gel. Then we can mix those two together to create our bioinks, which this is the inks that we are printing in the printer.
Is this a real functioning heart then that is printed?
So in the beginning, it was 4 years ago, I used this material to print only the patches, the cardiac patch, which has also blood vessels and is contracting spontaneously in the lab, and it's functional. And so we reached this stage about 2 years ago, which was very nice, and we also implemented it in animals, and we saw it viable and functional. So this was very nice. But then we wanted to move one step forward and to start engineering more volumetric batches.
What does that mean?
So here
what does that mean?
I mean, these patches are very thin. They're about 1 to 2 millimeters at height. And that is because our material is very, very soft. You can't just, in 3D printing, you print layer by layer. You print a layer of our gel with the heart cells, and then you move one step upwards, and you print another layer. This is how 3D printing works. I mean, also not in biomaterials, also like plastic. But our gel is very soft. If you're printing 6 to 8 layers, the material starts to collapse into itself. So in this stage, we developed a support material. I don't know if you saw the movies of the printed heart. It sits inside a bath of support material. So this support material is made of very, very small particles. And then you can print this layer by layer, this very very liquid material of ours in this support material. It holds this material in place. And you can just print whatever you want in every direction, and the material will remain the same position.
So I know you call this cardiac tissue engineering, which is amazing, because I can't think of many more things complex. Maybe the brain might be a little bit more complex, but you're right. We're getting the heart and the soul. And I wonder, we're going to need to take a short break, but after the break, maybe you can describe what are the real challenges besides everything, because this all sounds like that would be real challenging to a sociology major like myself. But what we really want to know is, like, you know, you got four chambers and you've got valves and you got all these like intricacies and blood vessels going different directions. So we're going to find out a little bit more how you did it and what still remains to be done. But we're going to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue our conversation with doctoral candidate and researcher at Tel Aviv University, Nadav Noor, about how he and his colleagues created the first three-dimensional printed heart using a patient's cells. We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Mila Battle. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of your health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with researcher and doctoral candidate Nadav Noor about how he and his colleagues created the first 3D printed heart using a patient's cells. And before the break, we discussed details around this process and wanted to ask you about the challenges involving the 3D printed heart.
Of course, there are many challenges in growing tissues in the lab. As I mentioned here, our first challenge was how to print this very liquid material. And we used this support material, which helped us to print large objects, even the heart. But now we are still dealing with the greatest challenge, I believe, that will be the next stage in this project, which is to grow and mature this printed heart. And I mean, we printed the cells and this material in the right positions, and the anatomical geometry is, although it's basic, it is well defined, but this tissue needs to grow and mature. And this takes time and very special machine. Which we are now installed and learning how to use. So, I mean, this printed heart is not yet pumping or contracting altogether. Each and every cell is alive and contracting, but all the cells need to speak with each other. And this will take time, and this is the very long-term research, I believe, that will be in the next few years.
Yeah, so you've got a cell, and I think there's a function of both. It sounds like the three-dimensional printing has to get better and more precise to be able to print out the different structures and have these cells differentiate, because you have to be more and act like a human heart. How do you do things like valves? And it seems like that might be particularly challenging, or is it no different than anything else that you have to engineer?
The heart to be printed is very small. It's about 2 centimeters, 2.5. And this is because of restrictions of our printer size and the amount of the material that we are using now in the lab. But we believe that the same technology can be used to print larger objects like human heart size. And because it's a very small geometry right now, it is very hard to print all the very small geometries like valves or tiny blood vessels. And actually, if we will go to larger objects, I believe this will be easier to reach this high resolution. Right now, our resolution is pretty good. We are about 50 microns. So we can print very, very, very small objects.
Yeah, I saw you printed in your article. You have a picture of a human hand. I was like, "Oh, that's someone's hand that you've generated," or it certainly looks like someone's hand. Is the science also similar for this regeneration of other tissues? Because I know the need for hands and feet are very, very large too.
Yeah, that's right. It's just a demonstration to show the abilities of our technology. However, we truly believe that you can use the same idea of taking this material and those stem cells to form many different tissues, even kidney or a liver. We hope it will one day reach the clinic. I believe it will take a long time, especially hearts, by the way. Mm-hmm. Still must note that this is a very preliminary stage. This is a very basic heart right now, and it's not yet contracting in the right and pumping blood.
So the heart doesn't have the rhythm the SA note or the rhythm, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. There's still many also different kind of cells that we need to incorporate. So I was very excited with all the enthusiasm in all the media. But I just don't want to, I'm sorry for disappointing many people, because I believe it's still very basic right now.
Well, I don't think we got disappointed. I think we got excited about the possibilities and can look towards the future, which, you know, clearly the work that you're doing requires funding. It requires team-based approaches and collaborative. You have to have your engineers and your scientists. How do you go about the next steps? Do you seek to recruit more collaborators, more funding? Is there other groups that are working and that you're working together? What's next?
Well, first, all of the, there are many, many labs. They're trying to reach the goal of engineering hearts or different tissues. And as in all research, we also collaborating. I mean, every research, we ourselves relied on many earlier researchers that have been done, and I hope that other labs will use the research if we publish. Of course, we also got many people that want to contribute to the effort. Actually, we're not recruiting because our lab is very small. We have no room. We're sitting back to back to each other.
Maybe need to print a new lab.
Yeah, this can be a good solution.
Well, how are you all advancing the research now? And what would the implications be for the future with respect to cardiovascular health?
Well, as I said, now we are mainly focused on how to mature this printed heart. We bought a very special machine that helps make the right environment and nourish this heart for a long period of time. I believe a few months it will be after we print it, and we will grow it for a few months. And the next stages will be to transplant it in animal models, like a small rat or mice. The future, I still believe it will. It's, I don't know, decades away, but in the end, we imagine hospitals with 3D printers, and maybe one day even replacing the need for organ donors. But it's still a very, very long way from being implanted.
Are you still working on your patch and the strengthening of that system? Because that's still also perhaps technologically maybe easier. I don't know. Maybe not.
No, that's right. The patch, I believe, is much easier to reach the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
We're still working on it, although we are mainly focused now on the art, because we're looking for the very large challenge.
So speaking of challenges,
there's also companies trying to use this material now, so I hope the industry will take it to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and speaking of challenges, in our last minute, you put out an article like this, and we're going to put up on our website the link to the article. There's some incredible pictures that you have in there about the process. We're going to have our great colleagues at the Health Sciences Librarian put up those figures so people can see it. What's that been like for you? Because you've all of a sudden been thrust into a space and place that few graduate PhD students ever go.
You mean about the publicity?
What's yes.
My opinion about the publicity?
Yes, yes.
Well, as I said, I was pretty shocked that it turned out to be such a big hype, media hype, so didn't expect it. It was very nice for me. I have two children, so my older son saw me on television. He was very excited for all week. So this was very nice for me.
But your doctoral advisor didn't say you can graduate earlier.
Actually, no. On the contrary, it said I need to stay in until the heart is completely functional.
I think there's some room for some negotiation there. Listen, we do need to put a bookmark in the conversation, and perhaps some stronger bookmarks will hold up that heart a little closer. But I think we want to thank you, Nadav Noor, for your research, for your willingness to come on the air all the way from Israel to talk about this work, and give us a glimpse into the future that's actually more real today as a result of you and your colleagues' work than it was maybe last year.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
We've been talking with researcher and doctoral candidate at Tel Aviv University, Nadav Noor, about how he and his colleagues created the first 3D printed heart using patient cells. We'll take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send a comment to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I recently had shoulder surgery for arthritis in my rotator cuff. I really thought this was going to fix the pain I was having, and while I do have much better mobility, I'm still having quite a bit of pain. Is this something I just have to live with, especially since I'm 65 and have arthritis elsewhere, or is there something more I should be doing?
Well, as I get closer and closer to that magical 60s age, I sure hope I don't have to live with it all the time. But I know some people do live with arthritis. It's a condition that's chronic and can flare and be painful.
But, you know, there's treatment available, and certainly there's non-conservative treatment as well, physical therapy, exercise, that will help control pain. So I think the pain can be manageable.
Yeah, and it's hard to know how soon after the surgery, you know, the expectations. I think typically for a shoulder surgery, it's going to be 6 months of rehab. And if it's only been 3 months, you got that mobility coming back, but it is painful. On the same token, it's probably a good question to ask your orthopedic surgeon about, because, you know, they may say, well, the goal of the surgery was to increase your mobility. We were never getting rid of all of the pain. I doubt they'd want to do an injection this close to the surgery, and I'm not sure that would be as indicated.
That's correct.
Working with the physical therapist.
Yep.
Right? Some exercise. Exercise
exactly.
is good for you. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm curious why palliative care doesn't get the attention it deserves. It seems like a service that pays for itself time and again, but I really don't hear a lot of doctors talking about it much.
Well, that's a great question. And I got to be honest with you, I don't think doctors traditionally have gotten trained very well in palliative medicine. Did you get trained, Jamila, in palliative care medicine?
I did not, and I didn't know much about it until really my father-in-law, who had Lou Gehrig's, which we appreciated having palliative care for him. That was kind of my first exposure to it.
So the ALS, which is not a good disease and probably passed away from
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and palliative care, what did they do for you?
They provided comfort, empowerment. They provided options basically for, I think, a realistic view of a debilitating disease that, hey, we don't have a cure, but you don't have to be uncomfortable.
You right. know? You don't have to suffer. And also sometimes realism that perhaps getting chemotherapy the day you pass away may not be what everyone desires.
Correct.
They might like to know a couple weeks or months beforehand and make a choice as to whether they want to continue with certain therapies that may not offer them as much advantage.
Exactly.
So I think there's, you know, in a healthcare system, it's complex because they may today need to be in a situation where they have to charge for things, and maybe the palliative care is hard to charge for, but in tomorrow they may make their money by keeping people out of the hospital and keeping medical costs down. So palliative care may be the breadwinner, so to speak, you know?
I'd love to see it swing that way, hopefully in my lifetime.
Yeah. Thanks for your question. I think giving it more attention and writing and sharing stories about experiences is really important. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I was prescribed a medicine called duloxetine for pain. I found out that this medicine has a boxed warning as an antidepressant and has possible links to suicidal behavior. Is this something I really should be taking, or should I ask about a safer alternative?
Well, maybe. How's that for an answer? Oh, maybe. What do you think, Laura? Is that the not good enough? Huh?
Not vague at all.
Well, that's because there's lots to say here. Let's see. What do you have to say, Jamila? I mean, you've used this drug in some of your work, probably in addictions, right?
I use this for chronic pain all the time, and I think it's just a matter of educating the patient. If you have suicidal thoughts and ideas, let me know, because you know, there's a risk-benefit ratio with all medications, and there's certainly a greater benefit if you don't develop those suicidal thoughts, if the medicine's going to control your pain.
Yeah. And this is used for both depression and anxiety and fibromyalgia, and so lots of things. And all of those medicines that have the antidepressant pretty much have a box warning on them. You know, it could increase suicidal thoughts, particularly in younger people. I always say start low and go slow to avoid the side effects being so bad. And then it may not be the right medicine for you, but it may be the right medicine for you. I wish we could say kind of more than that, but that's kind of how we have to think about it.
And if it's not the right medicine, that's okay. We have other options.
Yeah. So maybe we'll ask our good friends and colleagues at the Health Science Librarians to put up a little bit of information about what alternatives there are for chronic pain. We have some good alternatives and put up there, including some non-medications. Mm-hmm. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I have a question that I think maybe other people have. I have a hard time cutting my toenails as I've gotten older and have more trouble bending. I've thought about seeing a podiatrist, but I'm curious how I should figure out who a good podiatrist to see would be.
This isn't you personally.
No, although I have to admit that cutting toenails gets hard when you're 37 weeks pregnant.
So we were just joking around here, so we should all say congratulations. Our executive producer is going to have a baby soon. We're very excited. But I bet it could be difficult reaching down to get those toenails.
Yeah, it's not that easy.
Not that easy. Well, you'll have more empathy towards some of our older patients who have that problem as well. And, you know, I get questions about podiatrists pretty frequently, and I've always kind of wondered, well, like, how do you kind of identify good podiatrists? But it's probably not limited just to podiatrists. It could be any good provider.
So I look at the board, like your medical board, and you can look at the accreditation body to see if they're, you know,
if they're licensed appropriate, up to date with their license.
Yep.
You can look at online reviews. I mean, for better or for worse, they're on online reviews. And if you've got like 10 in a row that says, the person is always late, chances are they're going to be late when they see you. If you see 10 in a row that say, person's pretty good, unless these are false reviews, chances are they're pretty good. I mean, I don't take it more than that, but it couldn't hurt, right?
That's true.
I also ask colleagues, who does my colleague see? That's like, you know, the doctor's doctor,
right.
You know, who would you see? And, you know, ask around, because I think this is where your friends go. Right?
I think that's a great point, Adam.
We have a lot of doctors within our healthcare system and podiatrists, and probably LD healthcare system. There's a lot of podiatrists that are still in private practice, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
So find one who works for you. Well, that will conclude the house calls. We want to thank all of you for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu for any questions. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for the sponsorship. I want to thank great guest co-host today, Dr. Jamila Battle, and our guest today, Nadav Noor. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Jamila Battle.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.